Welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kolb, and today I'm pleased to have as my guest Dr. Sarah Myhill. Dr. Myhill practices integrative medicine in the UK. We've known each other for many years because we both treat patients ill from their defective breast implants. Dr. Myhill has a number of books. One that is of great interest to me is Treatment of Chronic Fatigue Syndrome and Myalgic Encephalitis. It's the mitochondria, not hypochondria. Hopefully we'll interview her in that book eventually. She has another book called The PK Diet, which we're going to be talking about in this hour. And today we're going to be interviewing her on the infection game, Life in the Arms Race. I believe that's the most recent book. Welcome, Sarah. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much, Susan, for your very kind invitation. It's an absolute pleasure to be with you.
I had no idea you were writing all these books, or I would have had you on the show earlier. I actually found out about the book through one of the integrative medical journals. So it was being reviewed in there. So that's how I came to understand you were writing books.
Bless you. Well, I mean, I don't pretend to be an author of any consequence, but I've kind of woken up to the fact that I can't cure the whole world on my own. and therefore,
right.
what I'm trying to do with my books is give my patients, as I call it, give them the rules of the game, and as I call it, the tools of the trade, so they can fix themselves, because there simply are not enough integrative doctors on this planet to deal with the huge demand for them that there is out there.
Yeah, there's been a great increase in chronic illness, especially this infectious-based chronic illness, in the last 20 or 30 years. You and I were introduced to it basically because people came in with chemical toxicity. You know, the silicone leaking implant, the saline mold situation.
Yes.
Then other people who have, you know, high mercury levels and high heavy metals that then affect the immune system, and they get viral infections, intracellular infections, parasites, yeast and mold, as well as bacterial infections. And that's why this book is so important, because we can't just treat the virus. We can't just treat the intracellular infection. We actually have to get their immune system back. So,
yes, that's exactly right.
That's why I love your book. You go, disease,
oh, bless
degeneration,
you. I mean,
death are all driven by infection. So that's true. That's very true.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, the subtitle of the book, as you have correctly iterated, is Life is an Arms Race. You know, you and I are a free lunch for all these microbes, all these bacteria, viruses, yeast, that would love to make themselves at home in our extremely comfortable bodies. Because if they can get ensconced in our bodies, if they can evade the defenses, they have a very comfortable life. They are well fed, they are well watered, they're kept nice and warm. It's a perfect breeding ground, and they can reproduce themselves. And the trouble with modern Western life, and indeed medicine, is that we are at every step of the way, we are breaking down our immune defenses by poor quality diets that are high in sugar and carbohydrates. Guess what? Bacteria and yeast love sugar and carbohydrates, so we are feeding the enemy. We have poor micronutrient status because of modern farming techniques, and we do not get the vitamins and minerals in the diet that should be there. And then we are inhibiting our immune systems and our energy delivery systems with toxins. And, of course, silicon is a major one. But as you say, there's mercury, there's lead. I got interested in this originally through my work with farmers who were being exposed to pesticides. But
right.
The 9/11 farming, you know, we are poisoning ourselves out of existence.
And the other thing that's difficult is that both mold and intracellular infections are very politically incorrect. And that's because if mold was disease, if biotoxins were true, then industry and government would have a lot of liability. And then you talk about mycoplasma fermentans in your book, the work of Dr. Garth Nicholson.
Yep.
Yeah, and and that is the weaponized. This was weaponized at Fort Detrick and has a patent on it. The weaponized mycoplasma that was involved in the Gulf War syndrome. That is a is a secret. That is a secret that when Garth Nicholson revealed that, he had four assassination attempts on his life. So you know it's a secret. So basically, we have, and we may have weaponized spirochetes as well. That, you know, for a long time in the U.S., I don't know about the U.K., but anybody who was treating chronic Lyme, they tried to take their medical licenses. So, and anybody publishing an old also had to relinquish their medical license. I got around it just by not publishing. Both you and I probably know that it's more important just to get the information out to the public than to actually get it into the peer-reviewed literature, because the peer-reviewed literature is highly controlled. So that's a little bit on why regular doctors can't conceive of, you know, that most or much of autoimmune disease is either due to chemical toxicity or intracellular infections. They just, it's beyond their, they don't know what causes it. I mean, it's like a, it's their idea that the body somehow attacks itself. I mean, that, that's like very interesting. I don't know why we would attack ourselves. You know, we would attack an organism inside our cell, but we would not attack ourselves, you know.
Yeah, but you have put your finger on the nub of the problems with conventional medicine, which is that the conventional doctors are not looking for causation. They are not asking the question why. Nothing happens without a reason. And I want to know, and you want to know, what are the reasons why the body is attacking itself. And the conventional doctors have come up with all these words which muddy the waters, like, oh, it's essential, like they talk about essential hypertension, or it's idiopathic fever, i.e. we don't know why. And they dress up clinical pictures as diagnoses. So they will tell somebody, oh, you're in pain because you have ME. But ME is not a diagnosis. It's a clinical picture. And we have to unpick the causes.
Yeah, I love it when the commercials for Lyrica on TV say fibromyalgia is caused by overactive nerves. What?
It's a joke.
It really is.
It's a joke. That's no mechanism.
Look at how the pharmaceutical industry made Lyrica for fibromyalgia, which is basically spreading all across the world. They developed a pill for it that you have to take for the rest of your life. Just like they developed the hypertension medicine, you know, if you detox the mercury, a lot of essential hypertension goes away. You know, you just have to treat the cause, like you say. But I love your, I love the theory in your book that what we have to do really is change the environment of the body. I mean, that's really what we have to do, rather than just treat every little organism that's overgrowing. It's hard to, we sometimes need to do it. They're really, really bad. But in general, preparing the terrain of the body to be less inviting to the organisms is the key.
That is the key. And the most important thing about this is that the interventions to do that are within the grasp of us all. And I'm sure, you know, you, like me, see many patients who have got positive tests for Lyme disease or positive tests for mycoplasma or whatever, and simply cannot afford the treatment that would be advocated, the antiviral, the antibiotics, the intravenous therapies or whatever. But I have now seen several patients who have had diagnoses of Lyme disease or mycoplasma or whatever. But by putting in place the necessary interventions to improve the terrain, as I call it, to improve the defenses, they have been able to heal themselves and be clinically improved substantially.
Well, the example of that I'd like to give is that I see women ill from their breast implants. Their immune systems are all screwed up, but they come in with their husbands, okay? Their husband and them both have a dog that licks their face, okay? And the wife has a number of different spirochetes and sometimes mycoplasma or other things, parasites, that the dog that are linked to the dog through applied kinesiology, but the husband doesn't have any disease. And yet the wife says, well, the dog looks his face too. I said, yeah, but his immune system's okay. So obviously,
correct,
if we can get the immune system back, it will treat these multiple infections that we're seeing.
Yeah, that is correct. And I'm increasingly coming to the view that unless that person puts in place the improving the defenses interventions like vitamin C, like diet, ketogenic diet, mm-hmm, like high-dose iodine, like heat therapies or whatever, unless they put those things in place, it's quite likely that the drugs will not work. And if they do work, then as soon as the drugs have finished, then they will be at risk of picking up those same infections again for the same reason they picked them,
correct,
up in the first place.
Or different infections. You know, the world is, I mean, the reports that I've heard is that sometimes the mycoplasmas are released into the air on purpose to see how they work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so what do you do with that? I mean, you know, you just being in the world, you can be you could be exposed.
Correct.
It's true.
But again, you will see in my chapter on mycoplasma that
uh-huh,
when healthy people are tested, they find a substantial mycoplasma load, or at least mycoplasma antibodies, in a high percentage,
right,
of them.
I think a lot of us are exposed to a lot of these things, especially if,
yes,
we have children and pets. I mean, those are the two things that increase the risk. But the pets and children aren't always sick. Sometimes they're just carriers. So,
correct.
The immune system is key, and that's what your book is about.
Correct. And it may well be that a certain amount of chronic infection, let's say, or exposure to viruses helps to train the immune system to function better. And this is one of the major concerns about vaccination, for example, because vaccination does not afford a good training for the immune system. It may afford a little bit of protection in the short term, but only for a limited length of time. And what this means is that we are postponing viruses that our children should be exposed to and allowed to deal with properly. We're postponing them, and so people get them when they're older. And I have seen several young men come and see me with a very severe orchitis, you know, huge testicular swelling,
mm-hmm,
because they've picked up mumps at university. And, of course,
yeah,
A, it's extremely painful, but, B, they risk infertility because they didn't,
right,
get a proper dose of mumps when they were a child.
Yeah, well, back in the day when these viruses spread throughout the young population, they would even have chickenpox parties where everybody would come over to get infected,
yeah,
to get it over with when you were a child, because these infections are a lot more dangerous even in your teens.
That's correct. That's correct. And in fact, you may be aware there's a new book coming out by a Canadian physician called Thomas Cowan, and I was lucky enough to be able to review the book, where he cites the example of German measles. And German measles, it's important that we acquire that full infection as children. And if we don't, not having German measles properly greatly increases our risk of brain tumors later on in life.
Interesting.
That's a
very interesting.
So you
combine that with the cell phone. You combine that risk with the cell phone electromagnetic risk and maybe the 5G risk, and we're going to have a whole bunch of people with brain tumors. That's just great. The neurosurgeons,
yeah, correct,
are already very busy with brain tumors, by the way.
Oh, I know. We are building up ahead of a tsunami of pathology, serious pathology, which will simply overwhelm our ability to deal with it. Even now, the epidemiologists are saying we will see a generation of children dying before their parents because they are so vulnerable to disease, virus, and with their appalling diets, they are having accelerated aging. I mean, I'm seeing cases of heart disease and cancer in young people that should never,
mm-hmm,
have heart disease and cancer.
Well, you know, a lot of heart disease and atherosclerosis in general has been linked to a spirochete that causes periodontal disease that goes internally. And actually, it can be prevented from spreading with Pepto-Bismol twice a day. It's very, very effective. Mm. Something in the Pepto-Bismol kills the spirochete. But the others, there's a nanobacter that can also cause the injury to the vessel. But in other words, the vessel injury doesn't occur because of high cholesterol. That's a myth. Now, high homocysteine is a problem, but it really is probably all infectious. I mean, it's really, I think medicine has missed how the basis of so many diseases are infectious.
Yes, and interestingly, I learned much of this from a very dear friend of mine who is a vet, and he says whenever we have almost any clinical problem in any animal, always look for the infectious driver. And the yep. problem with Western diets is they're very high in sugars and very high in carbohydrates, and as a result, mm-hmm. we tend to run a high blood sugar. Well, of course, that sugar oozes into every organ of the body, and it oozes onto the skin, and it oozes into the gut, and it feeds infections and bacteria. And I think that
right.
a likely mechanism by which diabetics, for example, are greatly at risk of infection, whether that's urinary tract infections or chest infections or skin infections or whatever, mm-hmm. is the sugar issue. And the sugar feeds the microbe. So it's not a straight sugar damage thing. It's the sugar encouraging the microbe. The microbe gets in, and if it gets into blood vessels, then of course there's going to be an inflammatory response in the blood vessel wall. And we know inflammation is very damaging. So
right.
it's sugar is centrally involved.
Yeah, the other thing that I found interesting, Dr. Perlmutter, who's a holistic neurologist here in Florida, he published a report of curing type 2 diabetes with fecal transplantation. So I think they discovered a bacteria in the gut that takes something out of the system that is necessarily not getting insulin resistance, but that's a whole thing that we need to explore. I think that's very interesting.
Yeah,
so
but
I think for development of disease.
Yeah, even the conventional doctors are waking up to the fact that the gut microbiome is really another organ of the body, and we have to look after that organ of the body as carefully as we look after our other organs of the body. And a major problem for the gut microbiome, or for Western microbiomes, is we are not feeding it correctly, because
right.
humans evolved to power the body with fat and with fiber. And fiber is fermented by friendly microbes in the gut to produce short-chain fatty acids, essential vitamins, and essential cofactors. Now we feed our bodies with sugars and refined carbohydrates. We have a problem here because this is the wrong food for our gut microbiome. And those sugars and carbohydrates, they get fermented into very toxic substances. They get fermented into alcohol, into D-lactate. They will ferment into hydrogen sulfide. And any one of these will poison the body directly. So sugar is a problem for so many reasons. It's a toxin in its own right. It's fermented into other pernicious toxins. And it feeds bacteria and molds in particular, and thereby encourages infections into the body.
Yeah, a lot of people get yeast overgrowth in their gut, and that produces the biotoxins of alcohol and aldehyde. There's actually a report in Japan of somebody with a very high blood alcohol level that never took a drink of alcohol. It was just that the yeast suddenly released the toxin into the bloodstream. And, of course, this person didn't ever drink anything, so had no ability to metabolize this alcohol quickly. You know, his liver wasn't revved up. So that's very interesting. And why don't you go ahead and explain leaky gut, because that's the end product of the gut microbe breaking down. Leaky gut is seen in many, many of the patients with these chronic fatiguing illnesses.
Yeah, yeah. Well, as you know, we are taught at medical school that, yes, we have these bacteria and yeast in the gut, but there they stay. And we now know that that absolutely is not true. We now know that some microbes in the gut do get into the bloodstream. And that even in people with normal gut function, that is the case. Example of this is if you look at somebody's urine, there will always be bacteria in it. The definition of a urinary tract infection is more than 10,000 microbes per mil, but we always have a few hundred or maybe a few thousand bacteria in our urine. That is normal. Where do they come from? They come from the gut. Now, if you have leaky gut, then you're going to get even more of these microbes coming into the bloodstream. The actual mechanism is called bacterial translocation, which is a terrible name for it, but it illustrates the point. It does happen. And once in the bloodstream, if there are just a few of them and they are relatively friendly microbes, then the body can deal with them perfectly well and has been doing so for millions of years. But if they are abnormal pathogenic microbes because they have been fermenting sugar, and if they get through in a great number, then all of a sudden we have an arms race. We have potentially pathogenic invaders getting into the bloodstream, and the immune system has to do something about it. Now, the immune system is our standing army, and there are some very good analogies with armies. And yes, we all need a standing army to keep countries, to keep invaders at bay. But if the immune system is activated within the body, that's like civil war. And civil war is very damaging to a country. People get killed through friendly fire, and inflammation in the blood vessels will damage the lining of blood vessels. They will damage, that will damage joints. It will get into muscles and potentially damage muscles. And I think of this as an inflammatory process driven by microbes. Some people will call this autoimmunity. Some people will call this molecular mimicry. It might be allergy to microbes. The mechanism, the name we use is not important, but the mechanism is it's these microbes in the gut are driving inflammation at distal sites. And I suspect that many cases of fibromyalgia is a fermenting gut microbe-driven pathology. There's some lovely work that's been done in Japan by Nishihara, who's demonstrated if you've got fermenting microbes in the gut, you will have fermenting microbes in the brain. And in the brain, there is potential for those microbes to ferment neurotransmitters. Maybe they will ferment noradrenaline into amphetamine. Maybe they will ferment GABA into LSD. And this indeed could be the basis of psychosis. And as you, I'm sure you know, lots of work done by Dr. Pfeiffer, by Dr. Hoffer, who have demonstrated if you take patients suffering from psychosis and you put them on a ketogenic diet and you give them a bunch of nutritional supplements, you cure them.
That's very, very
important information.
We're so molecular. That's right. Well, one thing, too, the way I understand it, I actually had leaky gut, so I had to really take a look at everything. As you know, 30 grams of silicone leaked out of one implant. All the symptoms were on the side, all the neurological symptoms were on one side. But basically, this is what I experienced. Right after, soon after you eat, usually within an hour, you start getting very, very tired, don't feel well, you get achy. And you have circulating immune complexes. Those circulating immune complexes you just described, it's the microbes, it might be fungus, bacteria, viruses, whatever, but the body attacks it and creates an immune complex. Now, that immune complex is probably what does the damage. Now, if you fast, and that's why we'll get to your diet in a minute, fasting is important. If you fast, which I was able to do easily because I'm a surgeon on call at 6 ER, so, who has time to do it? If you fast, you feel good, because there's no circulating immune complexes. It's really when you put food in your gut that this leaky gut occurs.
Correct. Well, again, my view is that there are two common causes of leaky gut that come up time and time and time again. The first is straight allergy. And, you mentioned Dr. Perlmutter, his book Grain Brain, illustrates the point that the antigens in grains, the antigens in dairy products are very strong. The antigens in yeast are very strong and will elicit an inflammatory response in the lining of the gut. And where there's inflammation of the gut, there is leaky gut. The two things go together. Right. So that is one cause. The other major cause, of course, is fermenting gut, because you are feeding microbes in the gut. The gut wall mounts an inflammatory response to try to stop these microbes from invading the gut, and you get information, and some will leak through. And that's why it is my view that the starting point to treat all Western, all pathology associated with Western lifestyles, like dementia, like cancer, like autoimmunity, is the paleo ketogenic diet. Paleo, because you are avoiding the major allergens that have evolved, and ketogenic, because you are cutting out the sugars and the refined carbohydrates and the starches, which are so readily fermented in the upper gut.
And what about the importance of probiotics and the fermenting, you know, the kefirs and stuff like that?
Yeah, well, they are very helpful. But the key point to remember about the fermenting products like kefir and sauerkraut is you won't recolonize the gut with those microbes.
Right.
The gut is working properly, they will be largely killed by stomach acid. But those dead microbes do have a function. They help to train the immune system. They help to physically displace other microbes. And, of course, the foods that they are fermenting are intrinsically low carbohydrate because those microbes have already fermented the carbohydrates out. So you don't get poisoned by the toxins of fermentation of abnormal microbes that are not friendly to the gut. So yes, I would agree, probiotics are a helpful adjuvant to a paleo ketogenic diet.
So you have a book on this diet, is that right?
I have. Because I talk about it so much, my patients say, well, that's all very well you talking about it, but what do I actually do? So
right.
I produced a book which I called The Paleo Ketogenic Cookbook, which details how to go about the diet, the problems that you often encounter in the early stages, meal choices which don't require any cooking or preparation. Because very often I'm dealing with very sick patients who do not have the time, they do not have the energy, and maybe not even the inclination to cook. So the meals have got to be very simple. There is a very good recipe in there, which I have to say I'm very proud of, which is a recipe for linseed bread. The point here is that linseed is only 2% carbohydrate, so it has very little that can be fermented by the unfriendly microbes. And there is a recipe in the book which allows you to make a bread which looks like a small brown loaf or like small buns, which is, you can do it in 5 minutes. It doesn't require any rising. There's no yeast in there. The only ingredients are linseed, salt, and water. And I make that recipe most days because bread is such a versatile food, and we can use that at any meal.
So can you give your contact information if people would like to go online and look at these books that you have?
Well, Chelsea Green have now published my books in America. They should be on Amazon, but if not, the Chelsea Green publishing website, you should be able to access these books.
Okay. Do you have any information? We do have, this is an internet radio show, so we do have people outside the country listening to us, the United States anyway, so... A lot of people in Canada. So
I'm fairly sure most of them are on Amazon, that's probably your best bet.
All right. Well, that's fine. Now, besides the diet, you talk about how important it is just to eat two meals a day and then to fast intermittently. You want to explain intermittent fasting?
Well, the important thing about just having two meals a day is that is a very good measure of being in ketosis. So I use that as a practical tool. So, you know, if people get hungry in the day, then they're probably not in ketosis and they're probably not doing the diet sufficiently strictly. So I reckon two meals a day because, as I say, that's a double check that the diet's being done efficiently. But
right.
Intermittent fasting is often helpful, and of course, with the very sick patients, you know, it's difficult to if they're very underweight, then you have to be careful here. but it is a very useful tool because the immune system is at its busiest in the gut. 90% of the immune system is gut-associated. And if you can give the immune system a rest and allow it to focus its activities in other departments, then it may be this will be a useful tool to help get rid of infection, whatever that infection may be. So it's not a tool I use a lot, I have to say, because I have others that are as effective and easier to do. But intermittent fasting is sometimes helpful.
Yeah, I've always just eaten two meals a day and a lot of times just one, and have fasted for a week at a time easily. And I feel that that really helps with the leaky gut, that really helps with the fibromyalgia symptoms.
Correct. Because what it does is it substantially reduces the total load of microbes in the body. And as you know, they come from the gut 99% of the time. They leak into the bloodstream, and fasting will literally starve those microbes out. Those important microbes in the gut will go into a state of dormancy, into a state of hibernation until the next meal comes along, and that allows the body to detox, to heal and repair, to deal with infection elsewhere. It's a very good therapeutic tool, and again, important because this is a tool that anybody can use. It's not expensive. It's something that's within all our grasps.
I want to talk a little bit about vitamin C. Here in the U.S., the FDA was going after companies that were producing IV vitamin C because it was working so well against cancer. And so liposomal vitamin C was developed. Liposomal vitamin C is a delivery system where the vitamin C gets into the body through the gut, but very, very effectively, so that if you take liposomal vitamin C three times a day, that's equivalent to IV vitamin C. So a lot of times I'm recommending liposomal vitamin C when we have to get high levels and you don't have to worry about the diarrhea that you can get from just taking regular vitamin C.
Well, I would love to see some really good studies that show that liposomal vitamin C increases blood levels to the same level as intravenous. I haven't been able to find any that show me convincingly that is the case. But vitamin C is well absorbed from the gut. The joy of vitamin C, as you know, is it kills all microbes. It kills bacteria, it kills viruses, it kills yeast, but is completely non-toxic to human cells. And I use vitamin C in two ways. I always use vitamin C to bowel tolerance. So that, as you know, Linus Pauling reckoned that a normal daily dose would be between 4 grams and 15 grams. That's 4,000 milligrams to 15,000 milligrams. And the joy of vitamin C is that you increase the dose and increase the growth and increase the dose until you get to that dose that just starts to cause diarrhea. That's called taking to bowel tolerance. And the interesting thing about that is everybody's bowel tolerance is very different because it reflects the amount, to the degree to which you have abnormal fermenting microbes in the gut, because that dose of vitamin C will kill off the abnormal upper gut fermenters. In fact, there's a study I quote in the book where this was used in Poland to treat Helicobacter pylori with very good results. And normally, as you know, Helicobacter pylori is heavy-duty antibiotics for 2 weeks to get rid of it. But the interesting thing is that the sicker the patient is, the greater the dose of vitamin C they can tolerate before they get to bowel tolerance. And this is true for acute infection and for chronic infection. Now, if you flip that logic on its head, what it tells you is that your bowel tolerance of vitamin C is a measure of your total infectious load that might be in the gut and it may be systemic. So this is an incredibly useful clinical tool, especially for people who can't afford expensive tests, to discern which microbe is there or otherwise. They can simply increase the dose of vitamin C, increase the dose of vitamin C until they get to bowel tolerance. And, you know, I have several patients who have done this, and they've got to maybe 60 or 70 or 80 or 100 grams of vitamin C a day. And then they've achieved bowel tolerance, then they've developed diarrhea, and then they find their bowel tolerance dose reduces substantially. Now, in the book, The Infection Game, there are three what I call groundhog chapters. Now, you all know the film Groundhog Day, where people come back to square, you know, the guy starts the day all over again and hopes for a different outcome. And I call them groundhog chapters because I talk about these things all the time. And the three groundhog chapters are what I call groundhog basic. Now, that's what we should all be doing all the time to optimize our health and stay well, i.e. before we even get ill. And then we'll have what I call groundhog acute. And those are the interventions we should put in place immediately we get any symptoms of becoming ill, you know, a runny nose, a sneeze, a sore throat, dysuria, dyspnea, or whatever. And that involves vitamin C, high dose of vitamin C immediately, maybe iodine, inhaled iodine, keeping warm, rest, you know, all good old-fashioned nursing interventions. And then I have what I call groundhog chronic. And those are the interventions we should be putting in place when we have a chronic infection. Now, the fact of the matter is, as we get older, we all get chronic infections. So, for example, you know, I was vaccinated in 1966, probably with the Salk vaccine, and all those Salk vaccines for polio were contaminated with simian virus 40. So I will be carrying simian virus 40. You know, like you, I have been bitten by fleas, I've been bitten by ticks because, you know, I'm a walker and a rambler, and I will surely have been exposed to Lyme. I will have surely been exposed to mycoplasma. You know, 90% of us have been exposed to Epstein-Barr virus. So I will be carrying those microbes in my body probably at a very low level. And what I have to do is keep the little wretches at bay. I have to stop them progressing to pathology, because pathology includes dementia, cancer, and heart disease. So the groundhog chronic chapter details all the things that we can do, and particularly so as we age, and especially so if we have pathology, in order to keep those that disease process at bay. You know, we have the potential to live to 120. That's how long our mitochondria can keep us going for. And if we don't get to 120, it's because we mess things up on the way. And I know I've made some mistakes, and I know I've messed things up, you know, some on the way. But all being well, I certainly expect to get to 100 and beyond. Because guess what? I'm enjoying myself. It's worth, you know, I'm enjoying my life. It's worth making the effort to put in place all these things so that I can continue to function at a high level for as long as I reasonably can. So I have a very selfish input here, but what I want is also what my patients want for themselves.
So let's go back to Groundhog Basic. I want to make sure we've covered everything in Groundhog Basic.
Okay, well, the starting point, of course, and Groundhog Basic applies in the other chapters as well, is a paleo ketogenic diet. That is the starting point to treat absolutely everything. Then we need a basic package of vitamins and minerals. Why? Because of modern agriculture and food delivery systems. The food that ends up on our plate is micronutrient deficient. Thirdly, we have to work hard at getting a good night's sleep every night. Most Westerners are chronically sleep deprived. We know they go to bed too late. Very often they're woken by the alarm clock. We need to sleep longer in the winter than we do in the summer. The average sleep requirement is probably about 8.5 hours. The average sleep in this country is about 7 hours of good quality sleep. And lack of sleep is a risk factor for all the diseases I've mentioned, cancer, heart disease, dementia. Then we have to get the right amount of physical exercise and mental exercise. And being physically active is very important for our bodies. It's I always think it's fascinating talking to chiropractors and osteopaths because they see things from a completely different perspective. They see life from the point of view of a body that has to function, whereas doctors, mm-hmm. we tend to see it from the point of view of, you know, internal organs that should be right. But a functioning body that is fit and healthy and can work and do jobs is an essential part of good health. And then, of course, being free from toxic stress. And in the modern Western world, that's very difficult because wherever we look, we are being poisoned by something. If it's not cosmetics, piercings, tattoos, additives in our food, vaccinations, the medical profession with all their panoply of drugs and goodness knows what, sick building syndrome. I could talk all night about the ways in which we are poisoning ourselves, and we have to be mindful that these are poisonous, that they are toxins, and take steps now to avoid those things. A little tip I remember being given by Malcolm Hooper, who's a professor of pharmacology: if you can smell something, it's in the brain. Why?
Right.
Because the olfactory nerve that smells is a direct extension of the brain.
That's true. And, you know, as we're going on to 5G, most homes now, at least in the U.S., have smart meters. And we have Wi-Fi. We have all sorts of other electrosmog. I just wanted to tell you that I'm sitting on my bed right now with my Faraday cage right next to me. I always sleep in the Faraday cage. That helps.
Well, I'm very lucky. I live in the middle of nowhere, and we don't get mobile phone signals here, let alone anything else. But it's coming, we will get to a stage where we are all subject to electrosmog. And as you know from the work of Professor Martin Paul, that upsets the ion channel gating across membranes. So we have a biologically plausible mechanism by which electrosmog damages membranes and damages cells at the most basic level.
Yeah, I had a patient this last week with EMS sensitivity, electromagnetic sensitivity, and typically these patients have really high free radicals in their blood and even, you know, just fluorescent light or any electromagnetic interference will give them physical symptoms. And it's just very difficult to operate these people who have these, you know, because you're in an operating room, you've got all these challenges when you're operating on people with EMS.
Yeah, but I think, again, you're absolutely right. It's very difficult to avoid. But I don't know if you remember an American physician called Dr. Sherry Rogers, and she drew the analogy that we are like a ship, a floating ship that can tolerate so much load. And my experience is that if you have electrosensitivity, almost invariably that person has chemical sensitivity and nearly always food allergies as well. And if you can unload them, if you can clean up their diet and clean up their gut and remove their toxic metals and other, you can very often improve their tolerance of inadvertent electrosmog exposures.
Right. That's true. Well, we found she had chemical toxins, and that's true of all EMS patients. They all have chemical toxins, often heavy metals. And it's just interesting, and there's probably a genetic component, too. There usually is, where detoxification defects, such as MTHFR and COMT, and there's other ones, probably are present in patients who go on to develop electromagnetic sensitivity.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And the first thing I always look for where there's electromagnetic sensitivity are heavy metals. Why?
Right.
Because we know metals make us a better acceptor or receiver of electrical signals. You know, we become a better aerial, if you like. And again,
right.
As I'm sure you're aware, one of the problems of the fermenting gut is one of the products is hydrogen sulfide. And so any metals that may be ingested into the body, they get converted in the gut to the metal sulfide, which is an organic form of that metal, and therefore it's so much better absorbed. And that greatly increases the toxicity of that metal. And again, if we have our poor detoxing, then we don't get rid of it. We tend to bioaccumulate it. And all of a sudden, we will have a substantial load of lead or mercury or arsenic or aluminium or whatever it happens to be in the body where it should never be.
That's correct. I'd like you to just say a few words about cancer. How is this system of our Western diet and lifestyle promoting cancer? Because back in the day, you know, when America was being, populated into the West, cancer was rare. Cancer
correct.
Was mostly associated with smoked food. But
yeah.
If you could avoid that, then there wasn't much cancer in America.
Yeah. Well, as you know, there are two stages to having a full-blown tumor. First of all, we have to have some damage to DNA, which means that a cell starts to grow out of control. And we know some of the ways in which DNA can be damaged, such as radiation. And of course, the main source of radiation is from medical imaging, chest x-rays, CT scans. Or the cell might be damaged by a heavy metal, as we've talked about, like lead or mercury or arsenic, they're known carcinogens, or by a chemical such as an organophosphate pesticide. So the first step is that cancer initiation. And then we have the cancer cell then has to grow. Now, the interesting thing about cancer cells, and this was known in 1930, this was discovered by a German physiologist called Otto Warburg, who won the Nobel Prize for his work. What Warburg demonstrated is that cancer cells can only grow on sugars and carbohydrates. They cannot grow on fat and fiber. And so we have a particular double whammy here because Western diets, yes, they're triggering cancer because of the chemicals in them, such as glyphosate, of course, and then they are growing cancer cells because of the sugar in the diets and the carbohydrates in the diet. And then we have other growth promoters like female sex hormones. You know, the pill and HRT are both cancer growth-promoting hormones. Milk, dairy products, you know, for example. Now, dairy products are meant for the young baby mammal. And if baby mammals don't grow very quickly, then they get predated, they get eaten, they get hunted by saber-toothed tigers or whatever. So dairy products are full of growth promoters. And that combination of sugar, which is growth promoting, dairy products that are growth promoting, female sex hormones and estrogen mimics in the environment, such as organochlorines, mean that we are feeding these cancer cells at a rate of knots.
That's correct. That's very true. So that's a little bit of information about cancer, which is all great information. I think that if we understand how to avoid carcinogens and then detox things like chemicals and mycotoxins that might be carcinogenic and then follow your recommendations for groundhorn basic, I think we can really decrease the risk of cancer because it's really rampant now in people in their 70s and 80s.
Yes. In fact, it's worse than that. It's almost considered the norm. I mean, I had a patient who came to see me the other day who she developed chronic lymphatic leukemia. Oh, she said, why have I got it? And the hematologist said, it's because you're old. That's absolutely outrageous. Age doesn't cause anything at all.
No, it isn't. Not at all. I found that a lot of leukemia is a chemical toxicity combined with a mildew. If you treat the mildew and the chemical toxicity, of course, there's also electromagnetic, especially in the children with leukemia. But these are the things that promote leukemia. So these are the things you have to look for when you're treating it. Well, we're coming up on the end of our hour. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say there's a lovely paper that Dr. Brewer produced a year or two ago talking about chronic mold infection of the sinuses and the molds in the sinuses causing mycotoxins, which drive a chronic fatigue syndrome. So your point about molds is absolutely spot on, and there's no question that they are a powerful driver of disease.
Well, I have over 500 saline, either saline or textured silicone or saline that have mold either around or in the implant, and it grows out mold after we take it out inside the implant, so we know it is. So those patients are treated with surgery, antifungals, and biotoxin detox. So I'm quite an expert on that right now because I probably have about 500 of those cases. So
incredible.
Many of them have sinus.
Well, I have to say I'm a huge admirer of your work because we do not have any plastic surgeons in this country who are prepared to stand up and speak in the open, honest way that you speak. So you are a delight to hear.
Well, thank you. Dr. Mayo, we've reached the end of our hour. Thank you so much for joining us. It's been a great conversation. I'd like to continue it with your other book, so we'll get that scheduled once it comes in.
Be a pleasure, and you're absolutely on the ball. You're asking all the right questions. I'm quite sure we're singing from the same hymn sheet.
Right. Well, this is Dr. Susan Kalb with Temple of Health Radio Show. Please join us next week.